This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today in the program, a panel of experts discusses the war in Ukraine, a year since the Russian invasion began. Professors from the University of Utah look back to the predictions made at the outset of the conflict and the reality of the unfolding war. The panel includes Majory Castle, professor and lecturer in the Political Science Department, John G. Francis, research professor in the Political Science Department, Sean Lawson, associate professor in the Communication Department, and Tyler Pack, visiting assistant professor in the Political Science Department. Moderating the discussion is Julia Martin, student forum host for the Hinckley Institute. This forum was recorded on February 1st, 2022.
The first question we're going to have is each panelist is going to give a brief introduction to this issue. We're going to start with Professor Castle, and she's going to explain a little bit about the situation in Ukraine currently.
I'd actually like to begin by observing that there is an attraction to the idea of a good war. I hope you hear the quotation marks when I say good war. The Ukrainian resistance to the Russian invasion, together with the material and moral support provided to Ukraine by us and other countries, may seem to us to be this elusive thing, a good war. So there's this tempting attractiveness of a good war, especially when we ourselves don't have to fight it, when the costs to us are some marginal economic inconveniences. But in truth, there's a real tension, there's a contradiction even, when putting the word good next to the word war, or in expecting that any large-scale endeavor that involves fighting and killing could be all good. So what's more useful here is the idea of a necessary war, or perhaps a justified war, a war that has to be fought for existential reasons. And to understand how this might apply to the Ukrainian government and to the Ukrainian people's resistance to the Russian invasion, we need to look at a couple of things. First of all, the question of nation and national identity comes up a lot when we're talking about Ukraine and Russia now. But let's be clear why we might want to have a better understanding of what Ukrainian national identity means. There's this claim that you've probably come across, proclaimed by Putin and various Russian pundits and ideologues, that Ukraine doesn't qualify as a nation, that it's somehow illegitimate, that it's an artificial creation, that the true identity of the people living in the territory called Ukraine, which they must be made to realize, is that they are either Russian or some subsidiary nation, maybe little Russians. There's this claim made by Putin and his supporters and allies that what Russia is doing doesn't even count as a war. You've heard, it's a special operation because of some historical unity between Russia and Ukraine. So let's dismiss this right at the start. We don't need to compare the relative founding dates of Moscow and Kyiv or look into that history. What matters is that Ukraine is today a sovereign state, that it has been a country in its own right with internationally recognized borders for, 31, 32 years. From the point of view of the international community, this is really all that matters. When other states start deciding that this or that country doesn't qualify to be its own state and they start invading, it's a blow to the heart of the existing international order. This existing order, imperfect as it is based on respect for the territorial integrity of sovereign states. So that's why Russia's invasion of Ukraine is a serious concern for every country in the world. But there's another reason why it might be useful to look at the idea of the Ukrainian nation, the strength of Ukrainian identity, because it may help us to understand what Ukrainians are doing now and are likely to do in the future. Before the invasion took place, you might have seen Ukrainian national identity as somewhat shaky. Given that roughly 30% of Ukrainians speak Russian at home, another 20% speak both Russian and Ukrainian at home, given that in the 2001 census, 17% of Ukrainians identified their ethnicity as Russian rather than Ukrainian. And of course, ethnic identities and languages are clustered by region in Ukraine, with ethnic Russian and Russian speakers, who are not necessarily the same thing to complicate it more, are found more in eastern Ukraine. But we should all be aware of how historical events can shape national identity. So we can think how the Russian invasion itself is strengthening Ukrainian national identity. It's strengthening the sense and the value of a Ukrainian nation. How names like Buha, if you've heard of what happened in that suburb of Kyiv and how people were killed and Ukrainians were killed and tortured there by Russian soldiers. Mariupol, destroyed by Russian forces. How those names have already entered into the Ukrainian national mythology. So decisions taken and actions initiated in Moscow have contributed to the strength and intensity of this idea of a Russian nation, which is, not surprisingly, increasingly defined as anti-Russian. I don't think I have to explain to you why. It's hard to foresee in the future a Ukrainian national identity that is not solidly anti-Russia, if not necessarily anti-Russian. And then quickly about Russia. In the language of international relations, Russia is a revisionist power. That is, under Putin, Russia is not satisfied with its current position in the world, with its current sphere of influence, or even with its current borders. Putin's Russia wants to revise all of this, or more precisely, to expand it. It wants to change things. This doesn't mean that expansion is a grassroots demand of ordinary Russians. Polls before the invasion suggested that Russians did not particularly favor armed intervention in Ukraine, but the Russian government's propaganda machine within Russia has apparently changed this. And I know in some of our discussion, we're going to be looking at various things that Russia has done not terribly competently or apparently wisely, but one thing Russia has been good at is its internal propaganda during this war, getting Russians behind the war, with exceptions with the costs of mobilization. Some other things to note, to the extent that we find it significant, Ukraine is a liberal democracy. Russia today is a personalistic authoritarian regime, which is important especially for understanding the drive behind Russia's revisionism. It is clearly Putin. Analysts disagree on whether it derives from his own psychological needs or it might be a function of the particular formula that he's worked out to stay in power. But the fact of this revisionism is undeniable. And it may go beyond what we call an international relations revisionism. What we've been seeing and hearing from Putin and his people and happening on the ground is quite literally the utter denial of Ukrainian nationhood, more the denial of the existence of a Ukrainian people. Already before the invasion, Putin was saying this, and it has gotten worse. His pundits and ideologues have been talking about the need to wipe out this non-nation called Ukraine. They've been talking about punishment, they've been talking about re-education, they've been talking about eradication. So this is most definitely for Ukraine an existential conflict. And at that point, I'll wrap up my remarks.
Thank you, Professor. The next question I'm going to have each of the panelists answer is, how has the conflict developed in the past year? What has stayed the same and what has shifted? We can start with Professor Francis.
Thank you. So my goal in my remarks is to talk about coalitions or countries' attitudes toward the Ukrainian war within Europe and across the Atlantic as well. So I want to give a kind of brief introduction and try to identify what organizations or countries seem to be the most committed and some that seem to be hesitant, depending on how things are going. One of the issues that should stand out, that as an organization, when the Russians did their invasion, they felt the same way in 2014, when the Russians were very active in taking over parts of eastern Ukraine, is NATO. If you read every statement that NATO has issued, it's without reserve, a complete condemnation of Russia, asking that they leave immediately. And this is very much going on in that discussion. And in fact, for some countries, particularly in Eastern Europe, what the organization that matters most is NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, because that is the assembly of military force. And the commitment that if one country is attacked, other countries must go to help it out. So in one way to kind of keep that in mind, and if I were to identify some of the countries who have been the most energetic in support of NATO, and very much the understanding that if you have NATO and you can get NATO engaged, you have the United States and Canada and the United Kingdom and other countries that have a tradition of committing forces. So keeping that thought in mind, if I were to identify the countries that have really pushed for a more active role, I'd say they're led by Poland, who is most alarmed or concerned about how this war would play out and its implications for Poland and other Eastern European countries. That's followed by the three Baltic countries, Lithuania, Estonia, and Latvia. Those countries, once independent, were taken over by the Soviet Union, and they have, they more than any others, really promote and favor the presence of American troops being in their countries. Just as a personal note, several years ago I reviewed for accreditation the three universities in Lithuania, including the military academy. And one of the things that stood out in all of that was talking about the American alliance and the recognition that the forces in Lithuania could not successfully resist a major invasion. So there are those countries. And then following may come as a surprise to some are Norway, Denmark, Sweden, and Finland, all of whom actually have very close relationships, economic and social investment, educational treaties with the Baltic countries. And this actually adds to that notion of and also really are unhappy with Russia for a whole host of different reasons from the Arctic on and pipelines going through that. So in general, that becomes, I think, some as well as the Czech Republic and Slovakia. All these countries have a kind of a connection with having a direct Soviet experience in many ways and don't want it back. Or see if they win, then that's the first step and it's dominoes that will fall. So you can, that's the way this is often framed in some of those countries. You can look, it's a real tie to test this. Every 6 months, the presidency of the European Union changes. So it will soon be Sweden's turn. And Sweden has not hidden the fact that they are going to do all in their power to keep the EU quite committed to helping the Ukraine. And they will think of other new schemes. So the amount of money they give and others, that is an important consideration. And also, this also ties into the European Union, which often in the past did not take an active or successful foreign policy line. But under Ursula von der Leyen, formerly a major German politician, she has essentially just affirmed 3 days ago the unconditional support of the European Union for the Ukraine. She has not backed away. And that's a key point. She was actually also a major actor in securing funds for all countries during the pandemic. And that gave her kind of a credibility to secure more funds in support of what's going on. All in all, there are 40 nations that are giving support to the Ukraine, either military support or they're giving essentially humanitarian aid. Among those 40 nations, two may surprise you. It's a modest amount in each case, but you would not necessarily guess it unless you really track this, and that's China and India. So you have to kind of keep in mind what is going on and how this has become a big issue more and more in that way. There are some other issues that stand out here, and that one that I want to draw in mind is that at the center of all this is Germany and the United States and the EU. They're the countries with the money, the connections, the borders to make this work. This has been a challenge for Germany, who has built its reputation on not being a military power, on working on trade and agreement and treaties and finding other ways to work with everyone. And all of a sudden, the current prime minister, the current chancellor, who has a ton of people in his party who don't like war at all in any form or fashion, is making this work and now giving tanks. Somehow, the Germans may, though I seem to be trashing the Germans for running their military, they make very good tanks. And so you have all of these issues that now seem to be working out. The heart of that relationship is their relationship with the US. And that is actually an important consideration in negotiations between the Biden administration and the chancellor's office in Berlin is very much working together on how they're going to make that happen or how that goes on. So you have all of that issue is to make that work. You also have a remarkable willingness on the part of countries in Europe to handle refugees. I do not have accurate data. Don't quote me on this. Some people say there are essentially 7 million Ukrainians who are living elsewhere in Europe. I don't know if those numbers are accurate. It's certainly a large number that you want to keep in mind. There are also 750,000 Russians. If you want to get good Russian food and speak Russian, go to Istanbul. There are lots of small computer shops have opened up all over in that area. So there are a lot of movement, and that's going on in that fashion. And so I want to say, where then in Europe would I find the most opposition? I would go to the Balkans. Just the other day, just 2 days ago, the Croatian leader condemned the giving of tanks, saying this was not a good idea. It would increase the probability of war. Now, the Balkans are a complex set of countries with great variations in religion and ethnicity. But if you're looking at all the other major forces in Europe, from the Netherlands to non-EU members like the UK, you would be left with the view it's a remarkable level of continuity in coalition building. Where that will take us, I cannot tell you, but that's the information I can give you.
That was John G. Francis, research professor in the Political Science Department at the University of Utah. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today, a panel of experts discusses the war in Ukraine, 1 year since the Russian forces invaded. Here again is your moderator, Julia Martin, student forum host for the Hinckley Institute.
Professor Lawson, would you mind sharing what you have been looking at and investigating in the past year and what has stuck with you?
Yeah, sure. So the main thing that I've been focusing on as a communication scholar is the role of cyber and information operations during the course of the conflict. And the main thing that I've been paying attention to is what is it that we expected was going to happen in terms of the use of those kinds of tools and techniques versus what has actually happened with what effects, at least as best we can tell from the open source information that we have. The world of cyber and information operations can be pretty murky. But based on what we have learned thus far, it looks like a lot of our major predictions about what most experts thought was going to happen in terms of the use of cyber and information operations in coordination with the initial invasion by the Russians, that those predictions really haven't turned out. It really didn't turn out the way that most people were expecting. So I'm actually working on a paper and a larger book project on this question right now. And the central question that sort of gets me going is, what, you know, who did we expect to do what, to whom, and with what impact, right? So if you go back and you look at a lot of the documentation from news media, reports from private cyber threat intelligence companies, statements from government officials, et cetera, in the weeks and months leading up to the Russian invasion, the dominant expectation was that we would see the Russians launch devastating cyber attacks through the use of destructive malware like wipers, et cetera, that would have large scale, even kinetic, right, physical implications, impacts on the Ukrainians. So this is things like shutting down the power, turning off the internet, taking down cell phone networks, and other way, you know, other means of communication, right? Also, of course, the spread of disinformation, et cetera, right? And that all of these things would be used together in coordination with the initial sort of standoff strikes through the use of missiles and you know, and precision-guided weapons and things like that as the initial strike that would help to, at least the theory went, cause chaos, fear, panic, paralysis among the Ukrainian citizens, among the Ukrainian government, that would undermine the Ukrainians' ability to communicate and coordinate their forces to be able to respond, and would undermine the legitimacy of the government and their ability to respond to the invasion in the eyes of the citizenry. That was the theory. That was the dominant prediction of what was going to happen. There were some attempts along those lines from the Russians. They did do a hack against a satellite communications provider, but reports since then is that it didn't really have the impact on the Ukrainians, who the Ukrainian military often relies on this particular satellite communication network. But the Ukrainians, according to what the Ukrainians say anyway, you know, maybe this is propaganda, but they claim that they anticipated that this might be a problem, and they had lower tech backup communication systems ready to go, and that they just fell back to the older systems and were able to use those to communicate. And there have been a lot of wiper attacks that we have seen as well, compared to what we've seen in the past. So wiper malware is where you get a piece of like a virus on your computer that goes in and essentially just wipes out all of the files, or it encrypts the files such that you can't actually use the files anymore. Or in some cases, it will do actually like permanent damage to the hardware itself. It'll mess up what's called the master boot record of your hard drive, meaning that the computer's just toast. You can't use it after that. There's no fixing it really. So we have seen more instances of that kind of destructive, at least destructive against data and hardware, kinds of attacks than we saw in the past. But even still, the majority of attacks have been much lower level, opportunistic sorts of disruption attacks. So like denial of service attacks, where you, for example, flood a government website with illegitimate requests for data to cause the website to go down so that other legitimate users cannot see the content on that website, right? So it's a way of just essentially sort of censoring content by taking a website offline. But those tactics are really, you know, they're not destructive, and those effects don't last, right? The effect of a denial of service attack only lasts as long as you're doing the attack. As soon as you stop, the effect stops, right? And so those kinds of effects are not long lasting. So these are the kinds of attacks that we've been seeing. We've also been seeing lots of use of cyber for intelligence gathering, for what are called hack and leak operations, where you break into some sort of organization, you steal information, and then you leak that information to the public as a way of having some kind of disinformation or information operations or psychological warfare kind of effect on the wider public or audience. So we've seen a lot of that kind of stuff as well. This leads to a couple of questions then, right? The first question is, number one, what effect has any of this had? Has it really helped the Russians in the way that a lot of people predicted that it would? Did these attacks cause fear, panic, paralysis? You know, everyone is like, you know, I think of it as like the Lord of the Flies scenario. Everyone's running around beating each other with sticks or whatever because there was a cyber attack. Has it caused a loss of support for the Ukrainian government, for the war effort, for President Zelensky? The answer in all of those cases is no. And part of the reason is, like, when you compare the kind of damage and disruption that you can do, at least in terms of what we've seen so far through computer means, through cyber attacks, it fails in comparison by orders of magnitude with the suffering, the destruction, and just the horrifying sights that we have seen from conventional modern warfare, right? We've all seen these pictures of people that have been tortured and killed and burned and maimed and, you know, vehicles that are exploded and burning and all of the destruction. Cyber just doesn't live up to that kind of destruction. Now, that doesn't mean that we haven't seen cyber operations. It doesn't mean that they haven't been used. It doesn't mean that they're probably not contributing in a positive way to both sides' efforts, but it hasn't lived up to the predictions that we've had thus far. If anything, in the Russians' case, it has maybe backfired. Professor Castle was talking at the beginning about Ukrainian national identity and unification. If anything, these kinds of operations have helped to unify the Ukrainians around their national identity, around their president, around the war effort, just like all of the other kinetic operations have as well. And then that leads to the final question that I've been following and a lot of people have been speculating about, and that is, why didn't the Russians carry out the kinds of attacks that so many people expected them to carry out? And we don't really know. We don't have good answers for that because we don't necessarily know Putin's mind. We don't know the mind of his generals necessarily. At least we don't, as the general public. Maybe our intelligence agencies have some insights into what's going on inside. But there's some speculation about what might be going on there. One speculation is that the Russians were overconfident. They thought they were going to roll in. They were going to take over Ukraine in just a couple of days. And, you know, why waste time with all this cyber nonsense? We're just going to roll in with our missiles and tanks. Zelensky's going to fall immediately. The Ukrainians are going to see us as liberators, and we're going to go about our business, right? That's one theory. Another theory is perhaps the Russians thought that they would end up with some sort of like a puppet regime that they would be sort of trying to prop up. And if you're going to go in and you're going to be in that kind of a situation, an occupation kind of a situation, you don't want to destroy the infrastructure of the country that you're taking over, because if you break it, then you're the one that has to fix it, right? So maybe they thought, okay, well, we don't really want to attack infrastructure through cyber means initially. And so maybe that's a reason why they didn't do it. And so there's a lot of speculation on why they didn't do the things that we predicted that they would. I haven't seen a lot of good evidence in support of most of those sort of speculation hypotheses or theories. One of the things that I've been arguing in some of my work, and what I will argue in the paper and in the larger book project that I'm working on, is that the answer might just be a problem of projection or mirror imaging, as they talk about in the intelligence community, which is that we keep trying to come up with reasons why the Russians didn't do what we know they should or we thought they would. But maybe the real answer is just we were wrong, right? We were too focused on the way we as Americans think about using information and communication technologies during warfare and projected that onto the Russians and assumed they would do what we would do. And they didn't, right? They might have a different view of what these things are good for and what the uses are. So that's sort of the theory that I am operating off of at the moment. And part of the reason for that is because not everyone got it wrong. So I'm a communication person. But, oops, I just hit my microphone there. I'm a communication person, but I do want to give a shout out to political science and international relations and security studies. There's some really good work that's being done by political scientists and in particular IR scholars who have been testing in a more social, scientific, empirical kind of way a lot of the assumptions that we as Americans have had about cyber warfare and information operations and how those can be used in conflict situations. And a lot of that work has been undermining and calling into question a lot of the dominant assumptions that we've mainly got from the military, from the intelligence agencies, and from private cybersecurity companies over the last 30 years. And, you know, I don't think it's fair to say we all got it wrong in terms of predictions. Most people got it wrong that were quoted in the media, but that's like current and former government officials. It's, you know, CEOs of private companies. It's folks like that. But quite frankly, there were a lot of folks in the academic world, especially in political science and IR, that did get it right, that have been looking at a lot of these assumptions, that have been doing empirical research and finding that a lot of our assumptions about the way cyber works and conflict don't really add up. And so if you're interested in these kinds of issues, there is a good basis of scholarship in your discipline right now. I assume a lot of you are political science folks. In your discipline right now that you can get started reading. And I would encourage you to do that. It's a very exciting and interesting area. And there's a really lively debate going on about what's happening in Ukraine with cyber right now, what can we expect in the future, what use are these techniques and technologies. And so, yeah, I encourage you to take a look at that stuff. It's super interesting.
Thank you, Professor. It's interesting to hear the impact or lack of impact that cyber warfare has had in the conflict. Professor Pack, would you mind sharing some of your expertise and what you've seen in the past year regarding this conflict?
Happy to. So I'm going to keep my remarks brief, partly so we have time for more questions, and also because the part that I've been following is the one I feel least confident about, and that is public support in different countries for the war, which I feel fairly confident in U.S. results, that the U.S. public generally supports maintaining or even increasing aid to Ukraine, although in the past few months that started to decline somewhat, largely driven by partisan splits, so more Republicans or Republican-identifying individuals are less supportive of maintaining or increasing aid and would like to draw that back. Pretty confident of those things. Less confident in how the Ukrainian population feels about the war. Although public opinion is mobilized against Russia, understandably, there is always the problem of what we call in social science preference falsification, where can you actually trust what people say or they're responding to outside cues? And so Ukrainians, again, I do trust that the majority of Ukrainians support the war effort. However, if you are in Ukraine that is not occupied by Russia, social pressure is to support the war effort. So it's hard to know how much of that's sincere. And the problem is magnified much more if you're in occupied parts of Ukraine. Do they actually want the Russians there or not? And can they speak honestly about it, right? Even if you could run polling and things. And then the hardest question is how the people within Russia feel about their government's war effort. Good luck getting accurate data or even anecdotal evidence about that. We have people who left the country, but they're not a random selection. They left for a reason. Concerns about conscription, other things about the war effort. And so those are questions I'm really interested about. How do the Russian people feel about the war? How do the elites around Putin feel about how the war is going and about supporting him? But that's also, again, what we have the least credible information about. And so the other thing that I'm interested in is when you have these big moments or what are seen as big changes in the war, so Ukrainian gains through the summer and into the fall with their counteroffensive taking back large parts of territory, conscription being announced in Russia in September, what effect does that have on public support? The discussion about more Western weapons and heavy weapons, so the main battle tanks that have been recently announced that'll be heading to Ukraine, what effect does that have on all of these different groups and how they feel about the war effort? And I'm happy to say more about those individual groups and what we do know and some speculation about what might be going on. But those are the areas that I've been looking into, which again, to me are the most interesting and the ones that I have the least confidence in saying anything definite about. So there's that unfortunate tension.
That was Tyler Pack, visiting assistant professor in the Political Science Department at the University of Utah. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. In this final segment, the panel takes questions from the live audience.
I've got a bit of like a tricky question, but I don't know what you think. Do you think that the people of Ukraine are better off as a result of all the funding and support that's come in from the West, which has maybe drawn out this conflict to be perhaps longer and have done more damage to Ukraine than it would have without that support? Do you think that the people of Ukraine are better off or will be better off as a result of that? Or if that maybe has done damage to Ukraine through drawing out such a long war inside of their borders?
That is a hard question. Depends on how you define better off. Possibly fewer people would have died if Russia had won the war, although they were doing a very bad job of that in the early weeks. Russia had a massively incompetent strategy in terms of taking Kyiv, taking some of these other regions. Russia seemed perfectly willing to inflict massive civilian casualties even before there was large-scale Western aid, although that came pretty quickly. So you can imagine a hypothetical where the war ended sooner, and so less people die and suffer, but I wouldn't want to answer for the Ukrainians, is that better than, you know, being occupied by Russia, is that better than fighting against Russia even with the death and devastation it causes? So both because I can't speak for them and because it depends on what better means. I'm gonna answer both ways for your question for that.
last year when we had the similar forum to this, Professor Castle pointed out that this war helped strengthen the NATO alliance and the world, like the world order that have been built in the last 50 years, ever since the end of World War II. I was wondering, like, in the last year, have you seen any changes to, like, the major structures of NATO that you think are important to point out, like, such as interactions with, like, Hungary or Turkey, and the, like, which have been, like, recent, what's it called? Points of interest due to the entrance of Sweden and Finland to the NATO alliance, possibly.
I'll just speak on Finland and Sweden. And
okay.
I mean, the switch around of Finland in regard to its position vis-a-vis Russia and finally and joining NATO has been huge. You know, from the past, Finland's past tradition for most of the 20th century of Finlandization and tiptoeing around first the Soviet Union and then Russia. And we see this complete turnaround with Finland as well as Sweden joining NATO. And this is simply huge. On the other Hungary and Turkey angles, maybe I'll throw that over to John.
Okay. So on the Turkish question, the president of Turkey is not having a splendid time domestically. There is major inflation. The economy is up the creek. And one of his ways of responding is to say, as any NATO member can, I veto your entrance into it. And that would be, say, Finland or Sweden in particular. He may be now changing to include Finland. But he also, whenever he says that, links that to the U.S. not providing fighter jets, which suggests to me that he's looking for an angle to say, of course, I'll let them in, when are the jets coming, or something of that order. So you have that as an issue. When you are looking at Hungary, it's been a challenge for the leadership because the Hungarian leadership has kept reasonably good connections with Putin. But there's also been a kind of silence. One of the is as well about they have not been critical of the Ukraine, and it's complicated in this way. The way the Hungarians draw their borders for having citizenship includes parts of Slovakia and other areas. And there's a lot of people who live in that who didn't necessarily want to be seen as maybe we can be Hungarian again. So they've had some problems about how they best make this work. And I think the Hungarians, are, if not enthusiastic about this, also are NATO members. And they also, many Hungarians, they don't want the Ukraine to lose, partly because they think maybe then the Russians will keep thinking of other strategies and move west. So that, I think, is how they're reading it. I hope that answers your question.
This would be for our cybersecurity expert. Does the effectiveness of cyber warfare change with more, less, or even no third-party support?
Yeah, so I think what you're alluding to there is another one of the surprises that we saw. If we go back to that question that I mentioned at the beginning, like, who did we think is going to do what to whom you know, with what potential impacts. Most of that discourse, at least in the United States discourse leading up to the invasion, was what's Russia going to do to Ukraine, right? And that question, you know, in terms of who's going to do what, focused mainly on Russia, the state, right, and like what are called APT groups, Sandworm, which is associated with the GRU, which is the Russian military intelligence. But then there was also a lot of talk about, Russian cyber criminal gangs. Like there's a group called the Conti ransomware group, right? That some of these groups might join in and help the state because they've done this kind of thing in the past. And they might, you know, help in attacking Ukraine. They might also unleash, you know, ransomware attacks against the U.S. and other NATO countries. And we've seen a little bit of that, but the thing that's been most surprising, I think, to most observers is other third parties jumping in, like the Anonymous Hacker Collective, the IT Army of Ukraine that Ukraine sort of pulled together very quickly after the invasion, and lots of other what are called hacktivist groups jumping in and coming to the assistance of Ukraine and carrying out a lot of cyber attacks against Russia itself. So denial of service attacks against websites, defacement attacks where they would break into websites and replace the content with like propaganda messages and stuff like this. So there's been a lot of that kind of activity. It's not something that was really on the radar in terms of the dominant predictions and the discourse that was happening leading up to the invasion. So that's sort of something that has surprised people. I don't know why it did surprise people. Third party sort of cyber proxies jumping in seems to happen pretty much every time we have a conflict like this or even much smaller conflicts. The question though that you raise is how effective is that? What does it really do? And that's really much more difficult to gauge, right? In part because in a lot of instances with what hacktivists do, it's really meant more as like a psychological operation or a propaganda kind of operation. And the effectiveness of those kinds of operations is really difficult to measure, right? So in communication, it's difficult to measure media effects consistently and clearly, even under sort of experimental laboratory conditions. It's even much more difficult, if almost impossible, to measure the effects in any kind of like objective way of media sort of in the wild, and especially media or communication, malicious communication like denial of service and website hacking and defacements and stuff like that during a conflict, and especially in a location like Russia, right? Like so what you were saying is like, you know, it's hard to just measure public opinion in general in that kind of a situation. Being able to measure the effect of these kinds of operations, these kinds of like psychological operations, is even more difficult. So there's a lot of third-party proxy, cyber proxy action happening. What effect it's actually happening and whether that's really helping anyone on either side, you know, like in any way that like they could live without, you know, like if Anonymous wasn't hacking Russian websites, would it make any difference to what's actually happening on the ground in the battle? I don't know, I tend to think not, but it's hard to know, it's hard to measure.
Thank you. All right, so I work for an IT consultancy. We do offshoring to, well, used to be Eastern Europe. We had 14,000 people in Ukraine, we had 8,000 people in Russia, and we've been putting a lot of money into moving those consultants to other countries. So I'm curious, have you seen evidence of brain drain to Russia? And has that been, because I can imagine the brain drain from Ukraine, they might still be able to tie back in, but from Russia, it'd be harder to grab people back and get their help. Have you seen any evidence of that or any effect from that?
Yeah, there have been stories about sort of IT brain drain from Russia, for sure. And of course, people have left Ukraine as well. But one of the things with, you know, the cyber and information operations side of things is a lot of that stuff can be done remotely. I think it's probably not as important to the immediate situation in terms of especially the like lower level kinds of attacks like DDoS and defacements and stuff like that. I think where that brain drain is going to become more important is over the long term, when it comes to like, you know, the things that need to be done actually on the ground to get to, you know, swap out hardware and make sure systems are still operating properly. That's where that brain drain is probably going to have more of an impact. But in terms of like IT consultancy and working with that part of the world, another reason that people are postulating for why cyber really didn't turn out the way we thought it would, the way we thought it would, is there's been a lot of assistance from Western cybersecurity corporations to the Ukrainians, starting even before the war. So Microsoft is the one that has been the biggest one in the news. They have their security and threat intelligence center, and folks from that portion of Microsoft have done a lot of work to help the Ukrainians. Other companies like Mandiant, Talos, which is owned by Cisco, have been doing a lot of work to help the Ukrainians with their cybersecurity. And of course, the U.S. Cyber Command sent what are called hunt forward teams to Ukraine in advance of the war to help them. And then, of course, those folks were pulled out, you know, before the invasion actually happened. So, and then another portion of that is sort of the offshoring, in a way, of data, important government data for the Ukrainians, where a lot of what was done to keep them more secure is moving stuff out of their own territorial data centers and moving it into the cloud, and especially cloud data storage centers that are not physically located in a place that the Russians are going to want to attack, even perhaps through cyber means they don't want to attack because they're worried about escalation. And so that was a thing that that's also been postulated as a reason why things haven't turned out. So, yeah. So your folks in your world are doing a lot to help on that front.
Thank you all for your questions. I have one more question for each of the panelists to wrap this up. If we can start with Professor Pak on the end, then work our way down and just take like a minute to answer. This might be a loaded question, but I feel like it's a question a lot of people have, is how will this conflict likely end, and what do you think the continued impacts might be around the world once it does end?
So you're asking me to predict, and so my baseline answer is pass. But I'll tell you the things that are interesting in the next few months. Both Ukraine and Russia seem to be planning offensive / counteroffensive, depending on how you define them. Russia has approximately 150,000 of its conscripted troops that they actually gave training. The other 150,000 that were conscripted were sent to the front with a month or less. Sometimes there were reports from soldiers who had brought in cell phones that they were conscripted and the next day they were at the front. And in some cases, you know, people died within about 3 days of being conscripted. But the half of them seem to actually be receiving more training, so they'll be marginally better prepared. You know, even 3 months is not enough military training. But so will Russia try an offensive? Will they be able to rope Belarus into it, which is some of the diplomatic chatter, but that isn't seen as very credible. Will Ukraine be able to take back any more territory? And what is Putin's end game? He annexes 4 territories in September, and he doesn't control any of them. He controls most of Luhansk and about half or less of Donetsk and Zaporizhia and Kherson. So what is his goal here? Is he using that as a pretext to justify nuclear use, as some people are concerned, that if that's Russian territory with Russian citizens, as he claims it is? But the next few months, and whether Russia makes any progress, and how people within Russia, both elites and the public, feel about that. Putin's walking a very dangerous line where his most ardent supporters are also very high supporters of the military. And if the military does poorly and they stop blaming generals and start blaming Putin, that will be when his back's against the wall and when the most extreme action might be taken. And so again, this is not a prediction because there's too many things this is contingent on. But those are some things to look at in the next few months.
I think that there is a long history in Russia, going back to the czars and going back to the Soviet Union, that if a leader really fails, he's retired. Sometimes they get to live and sometimes they don't. So I would think if, building on your point, if Putin continues to meet where things aren't going well, he may be, yeah, he keeps a villa in Italy, maybe that's where he can retire. But I think that would then say what happens next. Since I think the way the war ultimately needs to end is some kind of accommodation. And the accommodation, I would guess, and at least speculate for your consideration, is that Ukraine can't join NATO, but could join the EU. which would almost be like the same thing or the thing, and that would essentially send a message. That would be a Putin goes. If he doesn't go, I think the stalemate will continue for a very long time. One of the things that's useful to keep in mind is that sometimes Americans, including myself, are seen not to have a sense of memory or history. But if you break that down one level into ethnicity or race, you find people have very vivid memories. So Poles have a very vivid memory, and the second largest congregation of Poles is Warsaw, I believe. I was actually in, when the war broke out, I was at a conference in Chicago, and one of the things that was clear, the next day, the whole city was filled with cars with Ukrainian flags. And so I would not diminish the notion of that kind of level of intensity or memory continuing to give support for the war. Not unlike if you're of Irish descent and you go anywhere to Ireland, what do you discover? You find a lot of support for Northern Ireland being a part of the Republic. So I think one of the issues is this war may go on and it may end badly, but I cannot anticipate it ending anytime soon.
Rather than predict, I will quickly present one feature which I think is going to have various kinds of lasting impact, and that is the sheer scale of victimization of civilians that has been carried out almost entirely by Russia. This is something we did not manage to discuss, but it is simply huge. It's taken the form of abuses committed on the ground, face-to-face by Russian soldiers, ranging from murder, rape, torture, looting. It's taken the form of the huge, large-scale targeting of civilian targets. It has taken the form of large-scale forced migration in territories occupied by Russia, including massive kidnapping of children. The fact that it took place on this larger scale was not something that we anticipated a year ago. It's puzzling because it seems to be counterproductive from the Russian perspective. It has not weakened Ukrainian resolve. Its impact, in the impact that it's going to have in the future, whether, you know, Russia contributing to Russia's continued status as a pariah state, or to the even further strengthening of Ukrainian nationalism, and to how it's going to affect norms in other conflicts among other countries about civilian abuse. These are all huge questions, and this is a major impact this conflict has had.
Yeah, so in terms of the cyber and information operations front, we'll continue to see more of the same, right? We'll see attempts at destructive attacks with wider impacts. We'll see disruptive attacks like denial of service, which has been the biggest category thus far. We'll see hack and leak, we'll see disinformation, we'll see a lot of what we've been seeing. But a couple of things that I would be on the lookout for is, number one, as the overall Russian strategy changed starting last fall and heading into the winter, where they started targeting more civilian targets, infrastructure in particular, power, water, that kind of thing, we did see that while the overall number of cyber attacks sort of went down a little bit, they shifted in kind to focus more on those critical infrastructure targets, to sort of be a little bit coordinated, at least with the kinetic attacks with missiles and suicide drones and stuff like that on power and water and other infrastructure targets. And there's been a big debate among practitioners and scholars about the degree to which the cyber attacks are actually coordinated with physical military attacks or not, and what value add you get from the cyber attacks when you coordinate those with military attacks. So there is a little bit of evidence of coordination there that we've seen, but if we are indeed looking at an offensive, counteroffensive situation coming up towards the end of the month or in March as the weather begins to warm, one thing to look for is whether or not the focus of the cyber attacks, especially the destructive attacks, begins to shift away from this sort of like wintertime critical infrastructure terror campaign and to other targets that might be more coordinated with the military assaults on the ground. I don't know what's going to happen there. Again, there's a big debate right now about whether they're coordinated or not and to what degree and what the value is there. So if you want to follow along at home, keep an eye on that and see. We're doing real-time hypothesis testing here. And then the last thing I would say to look out for is disinformation campaigns aimed at the United States, especially the American right, to try to undermine support for additional funding or any kind of support for the Ukrainians. So in the end of the last Congress, the U.S. Passed a large aid package for Ukraine, but whether or not we will be able to do that again with the Republicans controlling the House is up in the air. And so if we're getting towards the situation where that aid package that we passed last fall is running out and we need to re-up and have more money, you could potentially see a hard sort of disinformation campaign, propaganda campaign from the Russians aimed at the American right to try to undermine support for passing any more funding. So those are the things I would keep a lookout for as we go forward. Potential coordination and shift of cyber attack targets with counteroffensives or offensives and disinformation campaigns to undermine American support.
We're wrapping things up there. If you'd like to hear other Hinckley forums, you can find them on our website, kcpw.org. This program is made possible, in part, by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your producer and host of this program. As always, thanks for listening.